some space age type music to get you thinking about space and the skies and the talk of things like exoplanets. You know, we got these super powered telescopes, and the discovery of exoplanets is picking up speed, I think we could say. And we have with us a couple of astronomers talk about exoplanets and what else is going on in the dark, in the night sky. Our exoplanet researcher is Thomas Beatty, an assistant professor in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, great to have you here. Also with us, a long time, I don't know how many times you've been on the show, Jim Lattis.
Got me.
100 times?
Probably not 100, but
director
maybe it just seems like it.
Director of the UW-Madison Space Place, UW Space Place, for at least another little bit of time.
A little short time.
He's retiring soon. So sorry about that, but maybe you'll still come back and be with us from time to time.
Oh, sure. You bet. I'm always happy to talk about this kind of stuff. So thanks for the invitation today.
He is, of course, faculty associate in astronomy at the UW-Madison College of Letters and Sciences. And we're going to talk about exoplanets, but we'll talk about other things as well in the night sky as we move along today. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or maybe your own experiences. What have you seen that's intriguing or interesting? What do you want to know about exoplanets? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Boy, we've been hearing and seeing a lot in television and in social media and newspapers about exoplanets. And Thomas, I'll maybe turn to you for to start with. What is an exoplanet, and how do you find them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So an exoplanet is just the same way, you know, that we have planets that go around the sun that make up the solar system. So the solar system are all the planets that go around our sun that we can see up in the sky. And an exoplanet is, this is the exact same thing. It's just planets that orbit other stars. So all the stars you see up in the night sky, a bunch of them actually have planets orbiting them. And the first one that we found was 30 years ago, 1995. And now we're up to almost 6,000 planets that we know of that orbit other stars.
And how do we, we're using some pretty powerful telescopes, I'm assuming, here for this.
Yeah, and the trick is with them is that, you know, the first thing is all of them are very nearby on a galactic or universal scale. All of them are inside the Milky Way, but they're all, for everyday usage, they're all super far away. They're at least a couple hundred light years, but they're all close to us on the scale of the Milky Way.
And a light year...
Yeah, light year. It's how far light travels in a year. I don't know, Jim. Do you know how many miles that is?
It's like 6 trillion miles, if that means anything. But it's, you know, the nearest star to the sun is the Alpha Centauri system, where there are exoplanets, and that's 4-ish light years away. So even the nearest star is a few light years.
So if you're going to jump in the car and drive a light year, you're going around around the world and around the world and around the world.
Yeah, those kind of numbers get. just start thinking about how long it takes light. Light takes 8 minutes to get from the sun to us on the Earth. So the distance from the Earth to the sun is 8 light minutes. So the. Not, you know, so maybe that helps put the light year in perspective. How much farther will that light go the rest of the year after the first 8 minutes? It's going to be out there, but it's not even going to reach our nearest stellar neighbors.
Wow. Well, Thomas, you know, you've discovered, you yourself have discovered exoplanets, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Yep. I've discovered probably about 2 dozen of them. Unfortunately, I haven't gotten to name any of them myself.
Darn.
I know. They all get
why
these
don't
catalogs.
You get to name them yourself?
It's an excellent question, Larry. I lobbied really hard with my PhD advisor And unfortunately, they all get these catalog names that, as we say, only a sentimental astronomer would love.
So the names are like X4 or 5 PW or something?
Yeah. Actually, no. If you work in it, you sort of get to know it, because a lot of them are named after the surveys. So there will be like, the ones we found were like KELT 1 through 20.
Okay.
Kepler something, but a bunch of them have catalog numbers that are HD 209458. Is actually a very famous one, but
why is that famous?
It was the first one that actually found that transited, so it went in front of its star. So for exoplanet people, HD 209458 is a number you can just reel off the top of your head. Like I said, only sentimental astronomers actually know these things.
Well, Why in the heck do we study them?
That's a good question. I mean, to start off with, I think, in the mid-90s, before, any exoplanets had really been discovered, there was just the basic question of, are there other planets around other stars? We didn't know that for sure. And so when we thought about the question of how do planets form, there was a lot of debate about whether or not the planets in our solar system were the result of a very rare event and were sort of a one-off, or if planets seem to happen all the time. And we now know that planets seem to happen pretty much all the time. We think that every star, on average, has at least one planet around it. So we know a lot more about planet formation. And secondly, we're really actively trying to pursue detecting life on other planets outside the solar system as well. So it helps us understand where planets come from, and then hopefully try and find life elsewhere in the universe.
Yeah. And Jim, there was a research paper published earlier in the last year, I think actually the last month or so, revealing the discovery of two exoplanets larger than Earth. Are you familiar with these? And orbiting a sun-like star.
Well, yeah, so that it's easier, correct me if I'm wrong, it's easier to find more massive planets.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of selection effects that go into the search. So there are some that are easier to find than others, and lower mass ones are harder to find than higher mass ones. I don't know about those particular two, but I do remember that about a year ago, a UW team discovered an Earth mass exoplanet.
Yeah, that's one I was thinking.
And that's kind of cool to find a thing. I think it was a Earth mass, or pretty close enough, I guess, to Earth mass. And that was I actually just happened to have that. I used this as an example last night. That was around the star HD 63433.
I know that one.
Yeah, well. Yeah, I'm sure. You'll want to jot that one down, yeah. But that was a team that included at least three UW astronomers that detected that planet. And the thing is that's not all that uncommon. These are, as Tom has said, they're coming along. We're up in the thousands now, and they keep ticking them off as they get better and better at finding these things.
Well, at those distances, we can't see them with our naked eyes. Any of them?
No, so only very rarely. We only have direct images of maybe about a dozen planets, but they're all super large planets, bigger than Jupiter, and they're all pretty far away from their stars. The analogy I use when I talk about this sometimes is that trying to see the Earth next to the Sun at the distances that we're sort of thinking about is like you're standing in New York City and you're trying to take a picture of a firefly that's about 5 feet away from a searchlight, and the two of them are in Los Angeles. And that's the sort of problem. And actually, I worked out the math on that once, and it's actually not quite right, because actually that problem's probably about 100 times easier than...
No, wait. So the telescope is in New York City.
Yeah.
And the firefly and the searchlight are in Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles.
And the firefly is a few feet away from the searchlight. So you're trying to pick out the firefly from the light of the searchlight.
Right, next to the searchlight.
Okay.
Right. So it's very hard. Yeah.
And that's easier than finding exoplanets.
Yeah, and that's 100 times easier. That's right. So it's simple, Jim. It's simple.
Oh, my gosh.
But, yeah, so all the ways we do it is we have to be clever. We have to be indirect. So generally, we never see the planet itself. We see what it does to its star. So we see the star moving back and forth. We can measure that. Or we see the planet passing in front of the star and making it appear dimmer from our perspective on the Earth.
So there's a little bit of, I mean, is this, okay, I think I saw a shade there. Is that, so I found an exoplanet or?
A little bit. There's, I mean, what I did for my PhD was run what we call a transit survey, where we just took pictures of the night sky for 4 years straight. And at the end of that, we could look at 1,000 stars and watch to see if anything had gone in front of them.
So you see a little flick, a very little decrease in the light from the star. It's like an eclipse.
Yeah.
Except it's, you know, we see the moon eclipse the sun and the sun disappears almost completely. But in this case, it's that firefly that's blocking some of the light of the searchlight, and that little dip in the light is.
Yeah, that's a very good analogy.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Analogy. Yeah.
No, it's a very good analogy. Yeah, and it's a very defined shape, so you know what the shape should be. But even then, we would get 100 possibilities. We'd get 100 candidates and then run them down.
In 4 years of.
Right. Well, we got more than that, but we would get 100 candidates that we'd have to look through before we got one real planet. So it was very emotionally trying the first when we started, because I remember there were some weekends where I thought we had a real good one and we'd wait for some more detailed observations to come in. And then on Monday we'd get the email and it turns out it didn't happen. And it was a real emotional roller coaster for a year or two trying to find these things.
And you've got them classified. They're classified as, I thought these are really cool ways to classify things. You've got super Earth and sub-Neptune exoplanets.
Yeah, they're it's funny names. It's sort of weird. It's watching the field. The names have sort of evolved. We always try and relate it to things in the solar system. So there's a super Earth, a sub-Neptune, a hot Jupiter. They're all related to the planets in the solar system. And people try and figure out these names for a while. Hot Jupiters, which are these giant planets that are thousands of degrees. People tried to call them roasters. That didn't really catch. I once had a debate at a scientific conference where me and somebody else got up and I argued for sub-Neptunes and they were arguing for Neptunes, which...
I'm glad you won that one.
Yeah. Well, it did have a certain panache, I guess. Somebody wanted hot Neptunes to be hop-tunes. That didn't really catch on.
Gee.
But, you know, we give these names to them, but it's important to remember that those are just based on really just how big they are. Like a super Earth means just a planet that's larger than the Earth. That's all that means. And a sub-Neptune is something that's smaller than Neptune. It doesn't really tell us anything about what these planets are like, which is now what we're really trying to figure out.
Yeah, yeah. Talking with Jim Lattice, director of the UW Space Place, and Thomas Bede. Thomas is an assistant professor in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy, and he does a lot of research on exoplanets. And I hope you'll join in. Maybe you have a question about exoplanets. Maybe you have a question about the night sky. I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the night sky and looking at exoplanets, we've been zeroing in on the exoplanets a bit with our two guests, Jim Lattice of the UW Space Place, Thomas Bede, assistant professor in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy, conducts observational studies of exoplanets. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Here's an email. Are you able to tell which elements or materials make up exoplanets? And if so, how in the heck do you do it?
A subject near and dear to my heart. That's actually what most of my research is on, is once we find them, how do we actually figure out what they're made out of? So that's a super good question. It's what we've spent the last like 20 years trying to figure out how to do. The basic idea is that if you get one of these planets, as we were talking about, that goes in front of its star, as it goes in front of the star, if you could imagine that in your mind, the planet, like the moon passing in front of the star, there's this little fuzz of atmosphere right around the edges of that planet. And the starlight, as it goes past the planet, that fuzz of atmosphere imprints on the starlight a little bit. And so we can actually measure the atmosphere that way. And it's a very subtle measurement. For something like the Earth, our atmosphere, it's almost the same thickness as the apple skin on top of an apple. So we can't quite do that yet, but we're actually getting pretty close. Mostly we do larger planets like Neptune or Jupiter-sized.
Because they have larger, denser atmospheres, more extended atmospheres.
Yeah. That's right, because they have larger atmospheres. But yeah, we're doing it. The last 3 years since the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope has really cracked this whole field open. So we've seen water, carbon dioxide, methane, ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, all sorts of hydrogen and carbon and oxygen and sulfur species, which are sort of what we expected, but it's very exciting because it tells us a lot about how the planet's formed. You know, it's like if you're trying to bake a cake, we can't actually watch the cake baking itself, but we can look at the cake after it's made, pull it apart, see what the ingredient list had to be, and figure out what the baking recipe had to be. That's sort of what we're doing with planets. We're looking at what they're made out of now and trying to figure out how they must have formed to have that composition we see.
Still trying to, still not quite figuring out in my own head, or maybe I just missed it. When you're looking at that atmosphere, then how do you know that here's an element of this or here's something of that?
Oh, that's a very good point. Yes. So when we look at it, we don't just look at, you know, one way to look at it would be to take pictures, like what I did as a PhD student, to just find planets. As we just took pictures and we looked for, as Jim said, that firefly going in front of the star. What we do with something like with the Webb Space Telescope is we take that light and we split it up into a spectrum. So we spread it out for wavelength and we sort of split all the colors up. And different molecules absorb different amount of lights at different colors. So the atmosphere, that thin fuzz of atmosphere, will look thicker where there's a lot of, say, water at those wavelengths. And so we'll see a thicker atmosphere there, and then it'll thin out where there's nothing really absorbing. And then for carbon dioxide, it'll get thicker again. So that's what we're looking for, how thick the atmosphere is at different wavelengths or different colors, and that lets us identify molecules.
A number of emails here. Why don't we see a bunch of questions related to kind of the night sky? Why don't we see much of the Milky Way in the springtime evening in the night sky?
Well, I'll take that one. So it's back when, I don't know, January or so, if you went out, you know, right after dark, you'd see the Milky Way stretching right overhead. Here in Wisconsin, it would be just high overhead. And a year later, it would be back. 6 months later, we'd be seeing the summer Milky Way stretching overhead. But if you go about a quarter of a year, then the Milky Way ends up being on the horizon for us, at our latitude, or roughly our latitude. And that's what's happening now at sunset. The Milky Way is more or less around the horizon. So it's there, of course, but even when it's overhead, it's diffuse. That's why it's milky, right? It's not very prominent. So if it's around the horizon, you're looking through so much atmosphere, you don't really see the Milky Way at all. So all you have to do is wait a few hours. At this time of year, if you wait till midnight, 1 a.m., the summer Milky Way will be will be high in the eastern sky, even at a certain point during the night, directly overhead. And the only reason we call it the summer Milky Way is it's still springtime, but it'll be there right after sunset, right after dark, when we're in high summer, July, August. Yeah. It'll get dark and you'll see the Milky Way stretching high overhead. So yeah, so springtime and autumn are times when the Milky Way is the plane of the galaxy that we live in. Right, so we're stretching the stars are not in a ball or anything; it's spread out into sort of a large disk. And so we're looking out of the plane of the galaxy. We're looking, and that's why astronomers that study galaxies and things like that, that's where you're looking into truly deep space. You're looking past our galaxy. Along the Milky Way, our lines of sight are typically kind of limited, at least in the optical. We don't see very far. But looking out, look up towards Ursa Major and Leo, for example. Those are constellations that are high overhead these days. There are major clusters and superclusters of galaxies out there because we can see so far out into space that way. So it's really, we don't see any of that. Even with amateur telescopes, it's a bit of a struggle to see like a galaxy cluster or something like that. You can see them if you got a good telescope and know where to point it. But that's why the sky is relatively dark and free of all the stuff that we find in the Milky Way, because we're looking so far out of the plane of our galaxy and so far into deep space.
Hmm. Interesting. Just to go along with that, another email. What, if anything, can we see at night with a pair of good binoculars rather than a telescope?
Yeah, so actually, it's a good time of year to be doing that. I can suggest a couple of things. The easiest thing right now, there's a very, very nice star cluster. It's very famous among amateur astronomers. It's called the Beehive Cluster. So stars often come in clusters. Our sun is not a member of a cluster. Probably was once upon a time, and the gravitational forces in the galaxy often pull these clusters apart, but they form in clusters. And so there's a very nice cluster in the springtime sky called the Beehive Cluster, which is easy enough to find, but it's even easier right now because the planet Mars is just a little bit to the east of the Beehive Cluster. So you can go out at about, let's just say, 9 p.m. as it's starting to get nice and dark. And you have to navigate your way over to Mars, which is not hard to find.
No.
It's prominent enough. It's not super bright like Jupiter is over there in the west. But find Mars with your binoculars and then scan a little bit to the, depending on what time you are, a little bit to the right. Just scan the area in the sky to the right of Mars and you'll see it. There'll be a very nice concentration of stars, and that's the Beehive Cluster. So, it's easy enough to find even without Mars, but Mars is up there kind of leading us right that way as it happens this time of year. So that's nice. If you get out a little bit earlier and you look at Jupiter with your binoculars, you'll see the moons of Jupiter, the Galilean moons. You don't really need a telescope. You won't see any detail on Jupiter, but you'll see the moons that are orbiting around Jupiter there with your binoculars. They're easily powerful enough to, most binoculars are easily powerful enough to do that. You can even see a few binary stars if you look up, for example, up at the middle star in the handle of the Big Dipper, which is called Mizar. It's got a companion called Alcor, but they aren't really connected. But Mizar itself is a binary star system. Actually, I think there's like six of them up there. But you can see the two widest space ones in most binoculars. You'll see that it's really two stars side by side there. So there's a binoculars will take you a long way. A little bit of time spent with a star chart and a pair of binoculars. So I also recommend a lawn chair, makes it a little easier on your neck when you're trying to scan the sky with your binoculars. But they're great tools.
Or one of those apps.
Right. There's lots of apps that will lead you around. Yeah, that's right. They're a good way to do it.
Thomas, do you ever sit there with a pair of binoculars?
Well,
most of the time, probably not.
Larry, I actually have two young kids, so most of the time when it's dark, I am fast asleep because I'm up at 5:30 a.m. every morning.
Yeah, especially with two kids. Oh my gosh. Well, here's a question. Another email. What is the most common atmospheric composition of exoplanets?
That's a very interesting question. So there's one answer, which is what's the most common atmosphere that we've seen? And that's easy. That's atmospheres sort of like what Jupiter and Saturn have. They're mostly hydrogen and helium, the two most abundant elements in the universe. So if you're going to make a planet, they're the easiest thing to use in making it. Generally, everything is close to what Jupiter and Saturn look like. But That's also because those are the easiest atmospheres to find. They're the puffiest, they're the largest, they're the easiest to measure. The real frontier now is trying to push down less puffy atmospheres, heavier atmospheres, something that's closer to like what the Earth has, we think. And there's a big discussion happening right now in the field about whether or not planets, small planets, keep this initial hydrogen helium atmosphere that we think all small planets should start out with, or if they lose that and they get what's called a secondary atmosphere that would be something closer like the Earth. And there are a lot of groups trying to hunt for those, but nobody's seen them yet. So we think a lot of planets should have atmospheres sort of like the Earth, but we haven't been able to detect those yet because they're so, the signal is so small.
And remind me again, a small planet, is, you mean small in comparison to what, Earth?
Or? Yeah, that's a real term of art, isn't it? Yeah, a small planet for me would be anything that's sort of 2 to 3 times the size of the Earth or smaller.
Okay.
Definitely the Earth falls into that category, but even something twice the size of the Earth would be small for us.
Yeah.
Hard to see.
Jim, you're agreeing with that?
Well, yeah, I'm just sort of thinking, as Thomas was saying earlier, we're constantly relating things back to our own solar system,
yeah,
which is natural enough, right?
Sure.
And the massive planets tend to be the ones that where a larger fraction of their mass are gases and lighter elements, and the we sometimes call the inner planets rocky planets, you know, because the bulk of the planet there is mineral and less volatile sorts of stuff. So that mass sort of leads into a distinction, well, a suspicion about overall composition, that if they're in the realm of the Earth mass, then maybe you're talking about a rocky planet. And if they're up at Jupiter mass, maybe you're talking about a gas giant planet, although I think that's yet to be established.
So those two extremes, I think we're pretty confident in. The fascinating thing is what happens in the middle.
Yeah.
Because there's this whole class, as we were just talking about, super Earths and sub-Neptunes, that we see them, we know how big they are, but we have no idea what they look like from looking at planets in the solar system. So a lot of the work is something that's sort of halfway in between Earth and Neptune. Like, what does that even look like? We have no good signpost for it. And it probably is right on this boundary, as you were saying, Jim, between something that's mostly rock with just a thin sort of skein of atmosphere on it versus something that's, mostly gases and even some ice thrown in. It's a really fascinating area because it probably tells us a lot about planet formation, but we're still trying to just understand what these planets are made out of, so we can't yeah, quite get to the finish line yet.
And I'm not sure if you brought this up, but you're looking for exoplanets in what is called hospitable zones. Is that right?
Habitable zones.
Ah, habitable.
Isn't that the first?
I thought it was hospitable.
It used to be called the Goldilocks zone. It's not too hot. It's not too cold.
Ah, well, I like the Goldilocks zone. That I like that better. So I had it wrong to begin with. Hospitable, it was habitable.
Well, we could get it going. I feel like Goldilocks sort of fell out of favor because I think nobody felt it was technical enough. But we could get hospitable going. But yeah, the basic idea is that certainly for life on Earth, we need liquid water. That's one of the basic building blocks. So if we're looking at planets, one of the things we can work out besides just their sizes is how hot they are, how far away they are from their stars. So one of the things a lot of people are trying to find are planets about the size of the Earth that are at the right distance from their stars so that their temperatures, they could have liquid water on their surface. They're not too hot. They're not too cold. So those would be possibly habitable planets. And we actually know of about 24 planets that are about the size of the Earth and at the right temperature that they could have water on their surface.
And there was, let's see, I'm reading here. There was apparently something in the news from Cassandra about life being found.
Yeah, I think Thomas should talk about that. But, right, that's been a lot of news just lately.
Yeah,
that's what everybody's looking for, right? So it's pretty exciting if somebody thinks they've found it, but then the scientists always have to debate this stuff.
I know. I feel like it's pretty difficult to win at a science, but I'm pretty sure if you found life off the Earth, you would win astronomy.
That's probably true.
No, it has been in a ton of news. There's a planet called K2-18b. Again, it's sort of a telephone number, but it's a planet that is... So it's actually, it's a fascinating idea. It's not a planet like the Earth. It's a planet that's probably about like eight times heavier than the Earth and about 2.5 times larger. So it's much larger than the Earth. And we are trying to figure out what that atmosphere is like. And one of the ideas that people have had is that one way that atmosphere could work is it could be this sort of hydrogen helium atmosphere like I was talking about. And underneath that, it has a liquid water ocean. Water is everywhere in the universe, and so it could be at the right temperature and pressure. It could be room temperature and room pressure, but it wouldn't be air like we're breathing. It would be hydrogen and helium. But that's okay. It's liquid water. It's at nice temperatures, and in principle, you could have life there. And so that seems possible with the observations we have. And so there's a team out of Cambridge University who have been trying to measure the atmosphere in more detail to try and detect gases that would be produced by life, like bacteria in the ocean. And the event 3 weeks ago was that they published a paper saying that they had detected gases that they thought came from life. So that's very exciting. But as Carl Sagan used to say, extraordinary claims do require extraordinary evidence. So
Jim's eyebrows went up with that one.
It's certainly right in this case.
Yes, it's a very big claim. And there's a bunch of discussion. The gas they were detecting, dimethyl sulfide, on Earth, it's present in our atmosphere, and all of it is produced by like plankton from our oceans. But there's a lot of other ways to produce it in other chemistries and other atmospheres. So it doesn't have to come from life. And then there's also a lot of discussion about whether or not it's even there. So I was part of a team that wrote a, you know, what we call a rebuttal paper, pointing out that the statistics weren't quite right. You know, they were claiming that it was clearly there, but actually if you do some other checks, that sort of goes away. And that it turns out there are other gases, other molecules that could be doing this, and it doesn't have to be dimethyl sulfide. So it's certainly a possibility on this planet, and a lot of people are looking at it. And we as a field are 100% going to go back and hammer this thing and actually try and get to the bottom of it. But I think right now I, you know, one of my PhD professors used to ask people, how much money would you bet on it when somebody presented some science result to gauge how confident they were? Like, would you bet your house? Would you bet your car? Like, would you bet lunch money? I'm probably at about betting lunch money right now that this is really there. It's probably pretty low confidence. But if it is there, it's super exciting. But it's it was presented, I think, in a very strong way that was not warranted by the data.
I gotcha. You mentioned statistics, and that reminded me of a new Wisconsin Center for Origins Research, which is bringing together, I think it's called
WICOR,
multidisciplinary center. What's the background? Jim, do you know the background on it? Or
I do, but Thomas should certainly address that because he's one of the WICOR. One of the WICOR scientists.
Well, why don't you start and let him go?
So the Wisconsin Center for Origins Research. We've had a series, at least one series of speakers down at Space Place, invited scientists from WICOR, and just that variety of scientists tells you something. We've had astronomers like Thomas, but we've also had chemists, and we even had a mathematician at one point. There's a large number of different sorts of disciplines, and certainly people in the biological sciences, a large number of disciplines that all come together over this question that we were just talking about. Everybody wants to know, is there life elsewhere in the universe? And that's a complicated question. It involves science. There are science questions in all these different disciplines, but in nature, it doesn't conveniently divide up into the way we organize science departments at universities, right? You need to have these scientists from these different fields talking to each other and asking each other questions and sharing results and things like that. So Y-Corps is a mechanism, a cross-disciplinary, cross-departmental initiative to keep those start those conversations and make research programs that cross the disciplines happen. Is that fair?
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, the way I like to say it's like the Avengers of of trying to find life somewhere else in the universe. That they're assembling this team, because actually the K218 planet we were just talking about is a great example of this, because the people who announced that were astronomers through and through. Mm-hmm. And they're very good at knowing how to look at an exoplanet with a telescope. But then once you get that result, you need to really understand your statistics. You need to understand atmospheres and oceans and geology and biology in a way that as astronomers, we don't appreciate very well. And so to actually do this right and to know that once we've seen something, if we actually want to find life on another planet, and actually be confident that we're actually detecting it and seeing it, we can't just have astronomers involved. We need to have biologists and geologists and oceanographers and atmospheric scientists and everybody all pooling their subject matter expertise into getting at this, because it's going to be a very difficult problem that's going to require all of us working together to actually get traction on. And Y-Corps is it's one of the only centers like this in North America. UW actually has a pretty unique set of skills that have allowed it to come together. So we're all very excited about it over the next couple of years. I think we have a real shot making real traction on this and have a real shot at detecting life in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
So the origins, I just occurred to me, the origins go... you find life on planets, as far as we can tell, and you find planets around stars. So how do you get stars? How do you get planets? How do you get life? Those are the kinds of origins that we're talking about there. And some of those things are traditional astronomical topics. Astronomers mm-hmm. have tried to study how stars form. But then suddenly you start getting into, as we get into the planet formation and then what happens on planets, and if life is just interesting chemistry, how do you get that on what kinds of planets? Those are the origins that are in the Center for Origins Research, the core part of the Y-Corps.
It's really cool. And here's a question or an email from Susan. I think it relates here in many ways. Susan emailed to ask why astronomers think there has to be water to support life on another planet. Might there possibly be a life form that is not water-based? Susan admits this question might reveal they watched too much Star Trek as a kid.
That's impossible. There's not too much Star Trek in anybody's life. Sad as a lifelong Trekker. Yeah, I mean, that's a super good question. That's actually a lot of people think about that. I mean, there are a lot of other candidates. Like, for one, one candidate for alternate biologies would be something like liquid methane, which is why a lot of people are excited about going to Titan, one of the moons of Saturn, because Titan has, the same way Earth has a hydrologic cycle, where we have oceans and clouds and rain and lakes. Mm-hmm. With liquid water, Titan has the exact same thing, but it's all liquid methane. And so there's been one lander that landed on Titan and measured the surface, and NASA is actually in the process of building a helicopter that they're going to fly out to, well, carry out to Titan, drop into the atmosphere, and then that helicopter will fly around and explore the planet. So a lot of people are excited about that. As a practical matter, though, we only have one example of how life works. And so if we have to design these gigantic missions that are going to cost, $3 billion to go try and find life around other planets, the baseline we're going to use is life like the Earth, because we know it works.
Yeah, we know what to look for.
Right. We know what to look for. We can design around that. And also, as a practical matter, if you're going to go to Congress and ask for several billion dollars, you need to show some sort of numbers that show you can do what you say you're going to do. And we can do that with life on Earth. But that's not to say people aren't thinking about it. We certainly are. It's just the only one we know works is life on Earth. So that's where we're starting.
I was thinking about the old Star Trek. The one Star Trek show that I remember that comes to mind is when they were on a new planet and they were walking among these rocks and trying to figure out where the life was, and the life was the rocks.
Was the rocks, yeah.
Yeah, the Horta episode.
Yeah.
God,
yeah.
I've seen all of Star Trek, I'm going to admit to you guys.
Yeah. We're in the same club.
Jim Lattice and Thomas Beatty, our guests today, as we talk space and exoplanets with him. And it's still time for you to join in. I see we have some more questions here. You can join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking space today with our two guests, Jim Lattice, director of the UW Space Place, and Thomas Beatty, who is an assistant professor in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy and somebody who studies exoplanets. It's great to have both of them with us. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Cassandra emailed to ask, would star clusters show the Big Bang was a chain reaction of multiple collisions because asteroids were spreading across the universe? That's an interesting thought.
Star clusters?
Would star clusters show the Big Bang was a chain reaction of multiple collisions?
I think no. But I'm not really following that too well. I mean, star clusters come out of star formation processes in the galaxy, and galaxies. Although galaxies formed early in the universe, there were a lot of stages between the Big Bang and the kind of galaxies that form star clusters. Now, early star formation was probably different early in the universe after the Big Bang. So the processes have changed a lot, and chain reaction wouldn't really be how I would describe what goes on as the universe has evolved into being more chemically complex and more active in the way star formation works in galaxies. I shouldn't say more active, but just that processes change as galaxies mature. At least this is the current picture. I wouldn't use the word chain reaction, and I'm not quite sure how to fit asteroids in there either.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing to remember is that the universe, when it was first starting, it wasn't like the universe today with empty space and then there was small, stars and planets scattered throughout it. It was much smaller. The whole universe was hot. Everything was jammed together. And then it expanded and grew. So it really is close to a Big Bang rather than a chain reaction.
Mm-hmm. Todd in De Pere has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Todd.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is, of the known exoplanets, if there was intelligent life on any of them, would we be able to detect any type of radio waves or any other type of wave or communication from that distance?
Hmm. Yeah,
that's something that a bunch of people, Todd, are thinking very strongly about. It's there's a whole field now called technosignatures. The way we like to call searching for life is looking for biosignatures. So we now talk about technosignatures or SETI to try and search for that. Radio waves are, it turns out, maybe a little bit tougher, because if you think about, well, actually, the radio that you're probably listening to right now. WPR does not want to be broadcasting radio waves into space where nobody's going to be listening, at least not immediately. So the radio, most broadcast radio tries to transmit at the ground. One of the main radio sources that actually on Earth that transmits into space would be missile warning radars. So there's some thought about that. Certainly, there have been searches for radio waves for the last 50 or 60 years, and we haven't detected anything, which really just means there's nobody really nearby transmitting. But there are other ways of detecting intelligent life. I've written about how we could, with next-generation telescopes, be able to detect city lights on the night sides of planets like the Earth with next-generation telescopes. Because it turns out if you look at the Earth from the night, it's not dark. There's a whole bunch of cities that you can see. And people have also looked at, now that we've been able to measure atmospheres, detecting industrial pollutants in planetary atmospheres. And that's a little tougher. Probably if you could see industrial pollution in a planetary atmosphere, it would not be a great place to visit. It would be some sort of like WALL-E planet. I don't know if you guys know WALL-E. That's a current reference.
Yeah, the movie.
Yeah. It wouldn't be a great place to visit, but that would be another way. So there are a lot of ways we could think about this, and people are trying, but it's hard. Even with all we've done to the Earth, we still haven't really affected it that much on a global scale.
Would human life be different? I'm reading this email off. Would be different if we lived on a larger planet that still has a rocky core. I imagine gravity would be a factor.
I guess we'd all be a lot shorter and stouter or something.
That's right. More gravity. Be interesting if there was no moon and there were no tides. The moon, it turns out, we think might be a pretty rare event, because the moon was formed when a planet about the size of Mars hit the Earth very early on, and then part of that got blown off into space and formed the moon. And if that's a rare event, then it seems like most planets like the Earth wouldn't have a really large moon like we do.
Yeah, and and you said there'd be a problem if we didn't have a moon,
Oh, well, we wouldn't have tides, and it's hard to say, but there's some thought that one of the ways that life on Earth arose was all the oceans mixing because of tides from the moon. So if we didn't have the moon and the tides were a lot smaller, that might have not allowed things to mix as well and maybe not let life evolve. But that's very, as I said, I would not put a lot of money on that. There's so much we don't understand about how life was formed on the Earth initially that's very conjectural.
Yeah, so and the moon notwithstanding, there's no reason why something more massive than the Earth, I'll just say double twice the mass of the Earth, that the same sorts of processes might not be happening on the Earth that would lead to life. So it's hard to say how our lives would be different, because you don't really know what there's a lot of other things. Do other planets have plate tectonics, which dramatically affects the chemistry of the soil and the atmosphere? And right here in our solar system, we have an Earth-sized planet, Venus, that doesn't have plate tectonics like the Earth does. And trying to understand that, and that's where a lot of the geology sorts of questions are going to come in. We have enough variety in our own solar system that we need to study that and try to understand how these planets work. And in order to have a context for when we learn more about these exoplanets and what might be possible out there.
And what's your big hope here for your next find, Thomas?
Our big hope? Every day we're finding new planets, new small ones. UW owns time on a telescope out in Arizona called WIN. The W in WIN is Wisconsin. So we're finding new planets, and we're using telescopes like the James Webb Space Telescope to try and measure their atmospheres. Like I said, I think we have a real good shot with YCOR and the team we've assembled there at making a run at detecting life, or at least finding a planet like the Earth around another star in the next 5 to 10 years.
So planets going around stars reminds me that of course the Earth goes around the sun once a year, and I've just been handed a note here that says that today is... the Earth has been one time around the sun since the last time you had a birthday. So, happy birthday, Larry.
Happy birthday from us to you.
Oh, boy. It's been many revolutions. I can tell you that.
We're not asking.
And thanks, guys, for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
It's been a lot of fun. Thomas Beatty and Jim Lattice of the UW Space Place. Thomas, a professor, and I'm Larry Mueller, and I'm a birthday boy today. Thanks for listening.